welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we are joined by magnanimous mycological scholar, Dr. Keith Seifert, adjunct professor in the biology department at Carleton University. Dr. Seifert has spent more than 40 years studying fungi on five different continents. At Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, he did research on microscopic fungi from farms, forests, food, and the built environment to reduce toxins and diseases affecting plants and animals. He was president of the International Mycological Association, an executive editor of Mycologia, and associate editor of several other scientific journals. Dr. Seifert is here to dive into his debut book, The Hidden Kingdom of Fungi, Exploring the Microscopic World and Our Forests, Homes, and Bodies. And in this marvelous book, he invites us to see our world as one full of microbial ecological succession, symbiotic interactions with fungi, and maybe we'll leave with an understanding that this epoch could truly be considered the Mycocene. Dr. Seifert, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
Thanks, Darren, for having me.
Well, thank you for writing such an incredible book. I was joking with you before the show. People don't really have to listen to my podcast. If they read your book, they get the highlights and takeaways of so many of the major themes and scientific discoveries about fungi. I mean, it is impressive in how dense yet succinct it is and covers so many different points. So thank you for your hard work putting it together. And that's usually where I like to start, is kind of the backstory of how you got to where you are today. And I know you've had a decades-long career, five different continents. So if you can, give us some of that arc to how your research career progressed, maybe what started this interest in fungi, and then what led you to want to write a book about it.
I think I'm a pretty typical mycologist in the sense that no one ever really grows up thinking they're going to be a mycologist. It's not something you talk about in the playground or in the bar, you know, when you're growing up. But my family, I lived in a mining town in northern Ontario, which is not a place you think a biologist would come from. But my family was, they came from the prairies, the Canadian prairies. So they were a farming family. And when they came to Sudbury, they really fell into this community that was very oriented around the nature around, that was around the city, even though it was kind of a, I said in the book, a degenerated ecological environment. Nevertheless, there were hundreds of lakes. Everybody had a cottage or a camp. And so we were always going out with my father's, my parents' friends, out into the forest. And, you know, there were hunters and fishers and everything. And my parents and my sisters were both really interested in gardening. So all of these things kind of just pulled me into the biological world. And then when I went to university, again, like most biologists, there's a professor that ticks all the boxes for you, And for me, it was Bryce Kendrick. And for one thing, his lecture followed like a deadly boring lecture. So he had an advantage speaking to us because he was so much better than the guy that was on before. And he was the first professor I had that brought his own research into the lecture. So you realized at that point that, hey, this is a living field. It's not just something that's in a textbook. And he'd written his own textbook for the course because he didn't like any of the textbooks that were available commercially. So he just lit the fire for me. And then after that, it was having the right opportunities at the right time and never really hitting a roadblock along the way.
Yeah, one, often there is that seminal figure that makes you realize this, or makes that world come alive, this vivid world of mycology and microorganisms. And I was curious, you know, it sounds like your research career was also focused on more of the microscopic fungi, ascos, and not necessarily your big showy mushrooms. So, you know, what led you down that track to study yeasts and molds and some of these often unheralded fungi that, as you show in your book, have a massive impact on human society?
I think it's kind of a psychological thing. You know, I think that people are interested in certain categories of things. And I was always interested in tiny things. I was always fascinated that there was this world out there that existed, that lived, that was vibrant, that we didn't see. We were just normally totally oblivious to it. And I like magnifying glasses. I like telescopes. I like looking into the and discovering that there were real things out there that we couldn't see. And that really, I mean, you see that all through the book, I think, that in the title, Hidden Kingdom. I mean, that's what it's about. It's there, it's big, it's huge, and we don't even notice it.
Well, and there's a particularly vivid depiction at the beginning of the book, just talking about that idea of magnifying and descending into the world, where you talk about basically being a microscopic organism, like in your on your kitchen floor, and seeing these massive pieces of pollen and flakes. So you really built a whole universe in the microscopic.
Yeah, I wanted to write the whole book that way, but it really wasn't.
Very Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, so there's Alice in Wonderland, and there was a movie, I think it was called The Fantastic Journey, when I was a kid, where they shrunk some people and put them in a miniature submarine and injected them into a body, a human body, and the movie was about them going through the body and going through the heart and all of this kind of stuff. And then another one called Powers of Ten, which started with a picnic and then zoomed out to the farthest known reaches of the universe and then in all the way down to the structure of the atom. And these kind of things really appealed to me. And that's kind of what I was after in that section at the start of the book, you know. But it also, I wanted to shake people out of their frame of reference.
It definitely does that. It definitely pulls you into this world that you're about to lay out for us. You know, and one of the big themes that comes up constantly throughout the book is symbioses. So I think sometimes we throw around different words like mutualism and commensalism. Maybe we don't throw around that word, but symbiotic. And it's interesting because you kind of set this framework where there is a symbiotic continuum that some of these relational, like mutualism and parasitism, maybe being on opposite sides. If you can, if I'm characterizing that correctly, tell us about that symbiotic continuum and why that's so important.
I think in the last decade, especially through the work of Suzanne Simard, who I think you've had on your podcast, but also other people, there's been a lot of focus on the mycorrhizal symbionts. And that's great. That's good that people have that understanding of that system and that it excites them so much. That's so valuable to the public understanding of what nature is. I wanted to broaden the picture of symbiosis to the full spectrum that academics consider when they talk about symbiosis. So it's, we look at it as if it's mutually beneficial for both partners. But you can see even in mycorrhizae and in another group of symbionts I mentioned in the book called Endophytes, that it slides even within the same one-to-one partnership. But sometimes it's better for one partner at certain times of the year and better for the other partner at other times of the year. And it's a balance. And I think I use the term ongoing negotiation. So if that's the case with a one-to-one relationship, when you have a one-to-many relationship, there's all kinds of different flavors of symbiosis that occur, for example, in a tree. And it goes all the way from something that's an overt pathogen or parasite. So the parasite needs the host. It can't grow outside the host. One example of this is powdery mildew. So people who have rose gardens or who are harvesting their squashes and cucumbers right now in our parts of the world will know powdery mildews on leaves. They're obligate plant pathogens, and that's considered one extreme of the symbiotic continuum. And then you go through this kind of middle ground where it's not exactly clear why it's necessary for either partner. And that's called commensalism. I call it friends without benefits in the book. You know, it's not really clear. There must be something, but from our perspective, we don't really see it. And then the more idealistic kind, like the mycorrhizal partnership or lichens, which you don't really see those partners elsewhere. With lichens, some of the algae do grow elsewhere, but mostly the symbiosis is stable more or less for the lifetime of that little community. And so we call that mutualism, because it's mutually beneficial.
Well, and it just expands that idea where, yeah, symbiosis is not locked into something beneficent. Symbiosis is a term that describes two organisms kind of inexorably linked in this cohabitation or kind of co-living situation, and it can be parasitic, and that's still a symbiosis, a parasitic symbiosis. So that framework kind of helped me understand these relationships more and more. And you brought up endophytes. And you do a great job in the book of talking about endophytes. This is one of the most exciting topics when I talk with people about, you know, the potential of all these fungi living within plants. And you even hint at the idea that maybe hallucinogenic or medicinal properties in plants could be coming from their endophytic fungal partners. The case, I think the example you used was morning glory seeds, that hallucinogenic effect that comes from those seeds is actually from the fungus inside of it. So where do endophytes fall on the spectrum, or do they move around?
Yeah, they move around. And if you think of them just in trees, which is the most kind of mind-blowing example to think about, because a tree, a mature tree, has hundreds of thousands of leaves on. Some trees are colonized mostly by one or two or three endophytes, but most trees are going to have a population of endophytes. So it's like an apartment building where everybody in every apartment is different and not related to each other. And they may not get along with each other, and the landlord may want to eject some of them. So that's kind of what goes on with endophytes and trees. And then with the needles or the leaves cycling through the life of the tree. So even evergreens drop their needles every few years. So they're dumping those endophytes, and they're picking up new ones are getting into the new needles. So that's changing as well as the tree ages, just as the mycorrhizae are going to change by chance or by whoever happens to come along or grow in through the soil from a tree nearby. So it's a very fluid system. And that's really interesting from a biological and ecological perspective, because the individual organisms are becoming ecologies. There's a succession in the body of the tree, or in our body, or whatever. So if you just take a snapshot at one point in time, you see one thing in one season, and then you go at another point in time, you might see a different kind of mixture. Whereas a lichen tends to be the same. There's sort of secondary things that come in and out, but the core partnership remains the same. And that's kind of like, I think I say in the book also, it's more like ideally like a human marriage, right? You're supposed to get one partner and stick together and through life. And that's kind of what lichens are like.
Right, right. Well, and it can be hard to imagine a stable marriage between humans when we are these unstable holobionts, as you call us. So what does that term mean? Because you just laid out beautifully symbiosis, and that we are these vast collections, or, you know, when I'm reading this book, you can't help but see every organism, because you pick out how almost every, I mean, whether we're talking insect, plant, animal, human, I mean, even fungi and their bacterial partners, I mean, everything is kind of a symbiosis, working with multiple ecologies of organisms in symbiosis. So what is a holobiont? What does that mean?
I certainly didn't invent that word. It's out there and being discussed a lot now. So holobiont is a population of organisms that functions like an individual. The microbiome has coming into common language now, in a large part from Ed Yong's wonderful book, We Are Multitudes. But that was more about bacteria. And when it comes to people, it is mostly bacteria. But that whole idea that what we thought of as individuals are actually collections of individuals for the most part. And then that's the norm. Mm-hmm. There are examples where that's not the case, but it seems that for most animals and certainly plants, macroorganisms, that's the case. They're what we call a tree, that's the skeleton, and you know, everything, all the cabling in around it is something else.
Yeah, it's a fascinating way to look at the world. And it does sync up with so many emerging understandings and health and in forest ecosystems. And so really blurring the lines between what is an individuated organism, what is a collection of ecologies. I think you define that, really help us wrap our head around this well in the book. So I wanted to make sure I got that concept out there as we continue. And then the other thing that goes along with that is how much of our working with fungi, and I do want to tease this out with specific examples because you give so many good ones, but the human relationship with fungi and understanding these organisms and working with them in our daily lives or trying to mitigate the effects of them, things like that. How much of this is really about understanding and managing ecological succession? And maybe that goes beyond just understanding fungi. Maybe we have to do a better job with all organisms. But specifically with fungi, how much of our relationship with them is really centered around managing and understanding ecological succession?
It's a paradigm shift in the way we look at medicine, for sure. I mean, medicine has been moving towards personal medicine or individualized medicine. And doctors and medical researchers have been moving towards that idea at the same time that genomic technology came along. And when they looked at the human genome, they realized there's a lot of things going on in the human body that we can't explain from human DNA. And so a lot of the functions that we need to be a functioning person is fulfilled by our symbiotic bacteria, particularly in our gut. And then when it comes to the fungi that are in our bodies or on our bodies, mostly on our bodies, we don't really know, because we know they're there. Dandruff, for example, I talk about in the book quite a bit in Canada, which is an uncomfortable topic for a lot of people. But nevertheless, they are there. They are part of our biology, our ecosystem. And we can come along and just kill them, which has been the general medical practice for the past 100 years, 150 years. That works sometimes, but the result is a diminished ecology. This is one of the reasons why people's interpretations differ, but natural diets are probably valuable because they carry along nutrients or microorganisms that are actually useful to our own digestion and to our own functioning of our skin and things like that. So in medicine, we need to consider this. In agriculture, we need to consider this. In forestry, we need to consider this. In any kind of ecological environment, we need to consider it, any kind of individual that we're trying to save, or a collection of individuals.
Yes, and I think you hit it right on the head. A paradigm shift is certainly, I think, what it represents in thinking about addressing, you could say, symptoms, or you could say, you know, negative externalities in the agricultural sense. I mean, you have to address the whole system, and this concept of understanding ecological succession keeps coming up over and over again in the book, none the least of which in agriculture. You know, we were talking before about these different symbioses, and really the negative part of that spectrum, the parasitism and even, you know, the pathogenic, is, I think, one of the biggest focuses of fungal research, because it has such a massive impact on our lives here, our ability to grow food, you know, these different rusts and smut fungi that impact our staple crops are a massive focus I didn't fully appreciate until I started reading more works and speaking with academics. That is where so much money goes, is to understand those ecological successions and those organisms. So when we talk about that, when we talk about bringing this to farming, working with these kind of negative symbionts, I don't want to put negative or positive on it, we start working with parasitic or pathogenic symbionts in agriculture. Do you see that understanding of succession and some of the, you know, maybe it's biocontrols, maybe it's artful use of other organisms or artful trying to nudge ecological succession along? Do you think that represents a real chance to supplant the current system of kind of chemically augmented agriculture that we've seen?
I would say it's going to be a big factor in it. I don't know whether it will ever replace all uses of chemical fungicides or herbicides, but the whole idea that it's an ecosystem that's being disrupted. So it's being disrupted. It can be disrupted by the disease that comes in. That does disrupt the ecosystem, and it can be disrupted by the management practices that are applied to that particular crop. And I think that the awareness is growing definitely in agriculture that there's more to the picture than people have realized in the past. And it makes a lot of sense to most people doing research in that environment that understanding the microbial component of soils and of the plants is probably the missing piece in increasing yields. And I had a colleague who was preaching that doctrine in discussion sessions at conferences and so on, not so much in print, but he was saying that in his opinion that about what we consider 100% yield is about 50% yield, and that all the rest of it is kind of micro. It's like microfinance in reverse. It's all micro effects of micronutrients, microorganisms, microinvertebrates, microchemical metal pollution, that kind of thing. And then these things add up to about 50%. He's probably not far off. You know, even if he's only 20%, 20% is a lot. You know, we need a lot of extra food right now. So if we can sort this out, as well as crop diversification, which is, we tend to plant monocultures, and I think people are understanding more and more that that's not really a great idea. In some circumstances anyway. So if we can put all these things together, we'll start incrementally to be able to get increases in yield without changing the use of land that could be left as forests or natural grasslands or whatever, without changing that over to agricultural land, which I think we've got enough agricultural land to feed the projected growth of our population. But there's a lot to do between now and then, if that's going to be true.
Well, I love that hopeful message. And I kind of started with this question that I really resonated with, because, I mean, you already gave the example of working with ecological succession in the model of human health and managing our own microbiome, which is a huge topic we can tease out more. This was one of the big ones that gives me a lot of hope when it comes to agriculture, is that we don't need to commit to the model that we really saw, petroleum-based products, things of that nature after World War II. Actually, my grandfather was a chemist working for Shell Oil immediately after the war, who helped develop a ton of these substances that I don't want near my food, but then I hear from other people like, oh, we kind of need it. So this holistic understanding of the organisms actually involved, the growth processes of this plant, of the plants, diversifying staple food crops, all of that gives me a lot of hope for we can move away from that paradigm and start working with what seems like a more holistic kind of systems-based solution, a better understanding what players are involved and how to work with them. But just then, kind of a even bigger frame of reference, because I talked about these symbiotic organisms that are more parasitic or pathogenic, and this is a huge part of the book, is what has been the role of, I mean, rust, like wheat and other rust epidemics? How have some of these pathogenic or parasitic symbionts on the crops that we love to eat, how has that shaped human culture? Maybe a couple examples from the book that were really poignant.
Yeah, which one to choose? there's so many cases through history of plant epidemics of plant pathogens leading to famine. The one that's most on my mind is the potato famine in Ireland. And that, in the end, isn't even a fungus, but it was thought to be a fungus until about 20 years ago, but that doesn't really matter. It was interesting for all kinds of reasons, but because the fungus came from the United States, actually, and went over in the boats over to Europe, and I think it spread from Belgium to France and then to, to Ireland. But anyway, so the whole idea of economic activities of humans spreading plant pathogens, it goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. This is nothing new. So, and it will continue to happen also. We can't stop it, really. But it was the social impact of it for me. And you also mentioned the cultural impact. And I'm not Irish. I don't have any background there. So it's not a personal thing. But knowing a lot of Irish descendant people and a lot of Irish literature and films and music and all of this, you realize, and when you go there and you walk around, even though it's 180 years ago now, you still see the signs of it, and you still see the sensitivity to the whole situation that arose between the British and the Irish at that time. So it played out in the troubles of Northern Ireland in the 1970s. And, you know, these epidemics, they don't necessarily, they're not just a scientific phenomenon. They're not just an economic phenomenon. If they really affect the viability of a society, which it did in Ireland, mm-hmm. they have profound after effects. And to me, that was really, to realize that. I mentioned in the book a trip I took to a place in Canada called Gros Eel, which was it was a quarantine island where the Irish immigrants were kept until they were cleared from having typhus. And it's now a national park, and you can go. And I went with a bunch of plant pathologists who were interested in the topic for that reason. And so we kind of got a special tour. So we were to pretend that we were immigrants, and they would treat us as if we were immigrants coming into the boats in 1845. And they didn't strip us down and make us wear sacks, which they did then. But anyway, they brought us through. And you see this station, and then you realize that, and then there's this graveyard there on the island. It's like the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, except for its plexiglass, and with all the names of all of the people who died. And you look through that to see the graveyard with the wooden crosses in behind. And it's a very, very moving thing. And in a way, that's what started me on the journey towards this book, in a way, just because it really got me interested in understanding the historic aspects of the field, but also the relationship of science in general to social issues. And that's a deep vein. There's a lot there.
Yeah, that is a particularly potent example. And I believe that was the Phytopathora infestans, the non-photosynthetic algae. And you do a great job of describing the impact it has in turning these potato to mush, because it's breaking down cellulose or starch?
I guess it breaks down the starch.
Yeah, it's breaking down starch and leaving behind this mush. And I mean, especially when it occurred, not understanding the ecology at play and necessarily what these organisms even are. I mean, how would you ever deal with that? And that is one thing when we start talking about this, is I do get a little worried. I wonder how we have ever been able to cultivate anything with some of the rusts and some of these again, negative symbionts, these parasitic and pathogenic symbionts. I guess, how at risk is the global food system? Because I believe there are parts of the book where you talk about rust spores kind of travel up into the atmosphere and get spread to different areas around the world. So you can't just neatly quarantine off an area where this is going on, it seems like. You know, how much of a threat do these represent in modern times?
Well, it's a threat. There is a mention of another race of wheat rust is called UG99. So that was causing a lot of concern. And 10 to 15 years ago, it was discovered in Uganda. That's where UG means. And it was spreading on the jet stream from Uganda through Southeast Asia towards China. And it was able to grow at higher altitudes than the standard normal rust races. So there was a lot of concern about that. But I think that particular example illustrates that at that level, at least, the world can cooperate. The countries do tend to share information about these kinds of outbreaks. Some of it is written into treaties. Some of it is written just written into trade agreements. So it's that part of things kind of functions. Similarly, I mention a lot about mycotoxins in the book, and they are quite strictly regulated. The problem is that the regulations are more strict in the rich countries than they are in the poor countries. And the poor countries are trying to sell their crops to the rich countries, so they have to send their best food to the rich countries and feed their worst food to their own population. And like that's an unintended consequence of this kind of international regulation, but it's a very worrying one.
Yes, and mycotoxins, of course, the infamous aflatoxin. And you know, I started never looking at peanut butter the same once I learned about the mycotoxins that affect some of our food crops. So just from your research in this area, or what do you think might be some preventions? Maybe if it's regarding mycotoxins, I mean, these are much different topics, but mycotoxins, or, you know, how do we protect ourselves against these rusts and other pathogenic fungi that impact agricultural crops? Is it regulation between governments? I'm not sure mechanically what that looks like. I mean, are there physical things that you, in your research, have found people can do to mitigate the impacts of these parasitic or pathogenic fungi?
So on a personal level, don't eat moldy food. You can't always see that it's moldy, so it's easier to say it than it is to do it. But you know, the most common question I get is, can I eat moldy cheese? I always tell people no. You know, you can modify the way you express it, but you know, if you can afford not to eat moldy food, there's evidence of huge effects of mycotoxin poisoning on the societal levels, again, in Stalinist Russia and parts of Africa. And, you know, it's just awful. But at the same, so you have to balance that risk against the risk of using pesticides and against the risks of choosing to eat organic food. And, you know, one of the most unpleasant conversations I ever had in my career was with a woman on the phone, and she really wanted to eat some moldy squashes or something that she had. And I was trying to explain to her about yes, organic food can be good, but if it means that there's fungi growing on your food and they make toxins that are worse than the pesticides, like, what is the relative risk there? So I don't eat moldy food, you know, and if you know that you can buy organic food that's not moldy, you can use it efficiently, of course, that's a good thing to do. One of the phenomena with rust that I haven't really mentioned, but is worth mentioning, is that they grow on multiple hosts. So they jump from one host to another. And so some of them are controlled by controlling the host, the alternate host. So not you can still grow the crop if you get rid of the alternate host. Then the rust cannot go through its sexual cycle. So as an example, the Asian soybean rust, which is a problem in the southern U.S., the alternate host, unfortunately, is kudzu. This is part of the problem. Kudzu is spreading. I don't know if you have it on the West Coast. I don't think so. But the rust jumps from soybeans onto kudzu and back. And so if you're able to control the alternate host, which is one of the things they did with wheat rust during and after the Great Depression, that's one of the ways they conquered wheat rust, was by getting rid of the alternate host. There's some really funny buttons like that you put on your lapel that you can see on eBay or Google or whatever. It's the kill this German fungus, you know, that it's a Nazi ploy to destroy our crops. So get rid of the, because the
Barbary. The
German Barbary. The German immigrants brought, well, not just the Germans, all the European immigrants brought their Barbary with them because they like to make jam out of it. So, but they did that. They wiped it out, the Boy Scouts and groups like that.
That is interesting, bringing in, again, that cultural element, to propagandize the fungus and these plants and make it a fight against the Germans is to eliminate just the host for this rust fungi affecting our wheat. So, you know, that also gets to something I really love about the book, which is it feels very practical in how to manage some of the, you know, you present this world where there are rusts that impact our agricultural crops, but then you give some ideas in the past of how they were able to mitigate those effects and how we might mitigate those effects in the future. Or when it comes to mycotoxins, you know, that our foods, especially, you know, I love organic foods, I tout organic, you know, we cut the mold off of our peach and think, oh, the rest of it's fine. And then reading your book, there's some very simple and very practical ways to avoid mycotoxins, like not eat that moldy food because you can't see how far that mold has actually penetrated. It looks like just on the surface, but it grows in three dimensions. So it might be just as, you know, just as deep, or it's hard to see how it's affected. So I really enjoyed that about the book, kind of the solutions that you offer. But, you know, mycotoxins is one scary side of fungus affecting our food. But then you talk so much about fermentation and about our positive relationship with fungus and our food. So I guess it gets down to that quintessential question. Did humans first develop settlements just to use fungi to make alcohol?
I think I said that in the book, and then the editor made me take it out. So it wasn't my idea. I think it's in Nick Mahoney's book about yeast, the sugar fungus. I think it's, can't remember exactly what the book's called, but anyway, he wrote a book about Saccharomyces, and it's quite a funny book. But anyway, there are certainly people who have suggested that, and there are certainly people, I think it's pretty widely accepted that our civilization cities grew up in order to be able to expand agriculture, and wheat was the one. And in the book Sapiens, I can't remember the guy's name, but the author.
Noel Harari, yeah.
Yeah, that guy. You know, he came up with the idea that I think it was him anyway, that came up with the idea that wheat had domesticated us and kind of develop some mathematical formula to prove that we've got much better boost out of the whole thing than we did. And so I took that idea one step further and tried to calculate out the number of yeast cells that were just involved with beer and wine production. And of course, were trivialized in terms of numbers anyway. But again, that's an individual, right? So, you know, they've all of these yeast cells, they're mostly clonal. So are they different individuals? So, you know, they're not part of a body, but they've got the same genetics and they behave the same. So I'm not quite sure what that means. But
And just when you talk about that in the book, who's breeding who? Are the yeasts breeding the humans? Because there are, God, I'm going to forget the number now. But yeah, I love kind of flipping that on its head and seeing things that way. And well, I don't like a lot of Noel Harari's conclusions. If you thought of that, that is a perspective I like. And just to think about, too, this double-edged sword where fungi are giving mycotoxins, making us sick in our food. I mean, how lucky it was that humans discovered their ability to ferment and transform our food in a good way. I mean, to what extent, break down for us as much as you can from your research as we find in the book, how did humans first start to domesticate these fungi? And obviously, we weren't there. Who knows how it first happened? But you did posit some ideas of how we first started enlisting some fungal allies to transform our food, and then how ancient humans may have, you know, moved these cultures around. And I just think that's interesting, domesticating fungi. How did we domesticate fungi to have this transformative effect on our food?
Yeah, I think most of it was accidental. And what I can't get my head around really is many of these toxins, like aflatoxin, there is an acute aflatoxin poisoning, but most of the effect is chronic. It takes decades to develop liver cancer from aflatoxin. So how are you going to relate that to some koji mold that you used to make soy cells 50 years ago in your life? You know, I don't really know, but I think that there's probably, at the genome level, there's probably some synergy. There probably is some kind of trade-off. And with koji in particular, there's multiple domestication events, and they all involve increasing the starch digesting ability of the mold. So that's what they were after. But at the same time, there seems to be a loss of the aflatoxin producing capability. So there's some kind of teeter-totter in there in the genome, perhaps, that once the starch processing abilities go up, the toxin producing abilities go down, maybe. Nowadays, people are deliberately trying to domesticate fungi. There's people in Vermont. I think his name is Ben Wolfe. He'd be an interesting guy for you to talk to. He's working on trying to domesticate different penicillium species to make different kinds of cheese. That's kind of an interesting thing to do. And now they've got the technology, both the genomic and chemical technology, that they can make sure that as they do this, as they modify their molds to make a more interesting cheese, that they're all not changing or introducing unwanted effects into that product. So it's quite interesting.
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating, like, because there is always that danger of how do you know if this mold is going to have a negative effect? How do you know if it's going to be something good? And I love that idea you just threw out, where sometimes our act of quote-unquote domestication, where we're introducing it to this environment of sugar water or whatever the environment is, may activate a switch within the organism to stop producing some mycotoxin and focus on a productive process that's fermenting our food. Man, that's lucky. That's kind of a risky game to play, but we do it all the time with these fungi that at this point we know very well. And I did love your examples about cheese. I did love your examples of all the different cheeses, the different molds that make your Camembert, your Roquefort, your Stilton in England. Whether we're talking about cheese or beer or bread, once again, I mean, it seems like we're working with managing an ecological succession, right? I mean,
for sure.
When we talk about making some, and even you can have the same fungus and the same ingredients, and there will be multiple fermentation processes and multiple, depending on just how long you leave something to sit and ferment, can make different products. So what do you think the future of that is in terms of, is it more managed ecological succession? Is it new organisms being introduced? What's kind of that future of fermentation in your mind?
I think there's a lot of awareness now that it's not a simple add one yeast or one mold to some milk or to some grape juice and you will get the product that you want. That there's hundreds of unknowns in there, and that have always been there, that give the concept of terroir or whatever you want it, however you want to label it. I think that now that there's this awareness that there's a lot more experimentation going on with fermented products, and a lot of it is at the artisanal level. It's not being done by big corporations. It's being done by small businesses, by hobby people. Kombucha has just taken off in the last 5, 10 years, at least in Canada. You can buy it in any store now. And that's a little fermented product. It has, and most of that is just done in a very basic level. I don't really know what all the microbes are that are in there. But when you look at things like the classic cheeses, the ancient European cheeses and so on, they really are looking at it in depth and trying to figure out, like, what is the difference between Roquefort and Gorgonzola and Stilton anyway? Is it just the milk? Is it what the animals eat and the microbes that they have in their gut that are contributing to the flavor of the cheese? So it's fascinating. And it all goes together with a real renaissance, really, in chemical analysis too, that the technology that's available now to do molecular chemistry is so much more sensitive and so much faster and so much more precise than it's ever been. So put those two things together and who knows what people may come up with.
Well, I love the descriptions you give too, how it isn't just as simple as one fungus. You use the example of sourdough starter, where there's fungus, you know, growing in kind of the creases in the hands of the, and the fungus growing in the room where the bread's being made. So all of these different players are going into that fermentation process. And then you had some great examples of maybe taking a fungus that someone was able to find in like an old shipwreck, and all of these kind of interesting organisms you can bring to bear. And it's really fun to start thinking of food that way, as like, what organisms are we bringing into this? Maybe, I don't know, it could be kind of gross or it could be kind of cool, bringing these organisms in to have them go to work and transforming our food.
Yeah, that whole idea of rot is kind of, that's again an extreme. This rot to fermentation is another kind of continuum, and there's a huge cultural aspect to that interpretation of that continuum, as all your mushroom listeners would know about mycophilic societies and mycophobic societies. It's kind of the same with fermentation. You know, some people want their food cooked and with nothing growing on it, and they don't want anything to do with mushrooms in there. And then others are quite happy to experiment with things like tempeh or whatever, kombucha. So, yeah, I mean, it's, nothing's going to appeal to everybody, but that doesn't really matter. I think the more that we can experiment with these things, more likely that, you know, I'm a great believer in kind of local economies and local food sourcing and stuff like that. So the more that a culture is able to feed itself with things that it likes, using local ingredients and local microorganisms, that's the ideal.
Yeah, it opens up whole new worlds when you start thinking about those microorganism banks as kind of this natural resource that applies to food, that applies to micro-remediation. I love that idea of this localized, decentralized. And then we can't forget that that same fermentation that applies to cheese and bread and beer, you also break down examples of chocolate and coffee, how fermentation are central to those foods. So a lot of us think, oh, I, you know, like you said, I might not like fermented foods, but really you can't escape it. Fungally fermented foods are everywhere. You're eating something made from fungal fermentation that you like pretty much no matter what.
Yeah. Well, the other part of it, to tie it back to the earlier discussion about invasive species, the more we're able to make products with our local indigenous microorganisms, the less the risk that we're going to either import something that's going to spread and become invasive, or that we're going to export that. So I think it's good biology in a way. It's good ecology. You use what you've got nearby, but you can't stop the spread. Microorganisms, all kinds of organisms, their business is to spread. It's to be successful. Right. It's to grow and multiply. And so that's going to happen. And you can't close the door on it. But we can certainly try to stop it from happening faster than it does naturally.
And you talk about that as one of the most challenging balances facing us now in the Pangeification of our world, which is another concept I love, as we're able to travel more and more, things basically are kind of coming together. Our land masses aren't as distinct, even if there's an ocean separating it. And you talk about that idea of what is an invasive species at this point. I mean, it gets into interesting concepts of biopiracy, biocolonialism. That was something interesting I thought was brought up. Just to skip forward to that part, you know, what is this idea of biocolonialism? Because we're talking about different foods from around the world that were born with certain microorganisms. And of course, there have been not just in food, but in medicine, all manner of different products derived from microorganisms and their incredible capacities or their incredible metabolites or enzymes, whatever it is. So what is this idea of biocolonialism? How, in that crazy balance of trying to stop things from spreading too much, acknowledging that they will spread, wanting certain things to spread, do we have to consider economic equality and remuneration if we are deriving benefits from certain ecological banks in a local area? You know, do we then owe that place some kind of recompense for all the products that we make from their amazing microbes? Talk about that concept a little bit, how it plays into this idea of balancing trade and microbes moving around.
So there's an international treaty called, or convention called, the Convention for Biological Diversity. And then there's some follow-up agreements. And the basis there is that any biological property that's removed from one country or one culture to another is a commodity. It must be paid for. There must be agreements on its use. The United States has not signed this, but every biotech company that I've ever dealt with in the United States or pharmaceutical company tries to play by the rules as well as they can anyway. So it's more of a political issue, I think, in the United States, but it's a political issue everywhere, obviously. But anyway, the notion is that the one that comes to mind and is not fungal, it's neem oil. So that was part of indigenous knowledge in India, that the antiseptic values of neem oil. But that was taken and turned into a product by Western culture before the Biodiversity Convention. There's a lot of hard feelings about that in India, that they didn't get any compensation. I don't know, maybe they get compensation now, maybe it's been negotiated, but at the time it was the Biodiversity Convention came along, that was one of the big drivers behind it. And also the antibiotics, because companies were going around the world collecting soil from all over the place and bringing it back to their own labs in Canada, Europe, United States, and then isolating the organism, and they were claiming all of the intellectual property for that, rather than sharing it with the country of origin. And so Costa Rica, you'll probably be aware, is quite, I don't call it aggressive, but like they're looking after their interests, yeah, their legal rights, their ethical and moral rights, in my opinion anyway, by insisting that anybody that comes in there and does biology, including taxonomists who might just want to collect mushrooms and bring them back to study for taxonomic reasons, they have to have agreements. They have to have permission to do that. This is good, but it does also create a lot of problems for things like international culture collections or international biological resource centers, because they have all of this material that was collected before. And how do you administer that? Should it be repatriated? Some people think yes. A lot of the countries that where this material originated, they don't have the infrastructure to look after it.
Well, and on the flip side of this, when in reading your book, I was thinking about, we talk about invasive species and impacts, you know, whether it's some kind of wheat rust or maybe even more scary, coffee rust, which you brought up in the book, that's really threatening coffee crops, which I hate to hear. But the idea of, you know, would those treaties then enforce damages if something escaped from an area? Now, that might be the kind of thing you could never regulate. How could you prove it? How many of these organisms have? They have agency. They move on their own. I can't control atmospheric currents. But yeah, that discussion opened up all these ideas, again, cultural and economic impacts for the movement of these colonies of microorganisms and their own natural ecological succession, and how our culture is kind of adapting our different frameworks to try to work with these organisms. It's really fascinating. Well, you know, another big part of the book that I know a lot of people are interested in, I'm sure you get questions about all the time, is the impacts of these microorganisms, these fungi, these molds in our homes. So I guess, how many fungal species live with us in our homes? And then we could talk a little bit about, you know, everyone's growing fear of mold in the home.
Well, a house is not one ecosystem. A house has microecosystems like the bathroom, you know, it's tropical rainforest, and you know, your refrigerator is the Arctic, but most of your house is desert. And so there's a lot of dry loving fungi that grow in houses. The DNA suggests that there are, I think the average that I saw quoted recently was about 2,000 fungal species in the average house, the DNA of that many species. Right. But that doesn't, it's very difficult to subtract out the ones that have just blown in through the window. And so you'll find statements that the indoor mold population just reflects the outdoor mold population. And it's not an artifact of the method. The method is detecting these things in the house. The question is, what is growing in the house? And then you have to think of these microenvironments like your refrigerator or your compost heap, which is like a big chunk of humus. And if you go in and you isolate fungi with cultures, you'll find, let's say, 50 to 200. It really depends how fastidious you are about it. But I think that fungal growth in houses is normal. Excess fungal growth is not normal. What's the difference? That's a good question. And that varies from place to place, because if you're in the tropics, you're going to have more fungi in your house than you are, you would think, than you are in northern environments like where I live, except for that's not true because we close our windows all the time. And in the tropics, they keep the windows, they don't even have windows quite often. The buildings are just open. So it's not really that straightforward. But nevertheless, what really gets serious is if there's immunocompromised people or hypersensitive people that have asthma, and then bad asthma, like life-threatening asthma. And these are the people that really have a lot of problems. And then there's the overall question of hygiene in a house. So if the house is a midden, you know, if it's filled with garbage, if it's got all kinds of cardboard and rotten wood and stuff in the basement, and it's inhabited by people who are heavy smokers, and then the people who live there are automatically at a disadvantage health-wise, and then they can have serious problems with mold. So the serious mold that everybody's afraid of is called Stachybotrys, and that does make quite heavy-duty toxins. But the trick is no one really understands how it gets into the air, because it's a sticky thing. It grows on wet wallpaper and things like that. So it likes things with cellulose. But the spores are really heavy, and they just stick there. So it's not really clear how that toxin gets out into people's bodies. But it is clear that when it does, especially babies, can have very serious health effects from that. And there's all this hysteria in the press. I shouldn't call it hysteria, but there's a lot of hyperbole in the press, and it's rarely necessary, like, to tear a house down. Sometimes it is, but
that was one thing that struck me, was you got to be more comfortable with there are fungal colonies in the home. This is throughout the book, on our food, in forest ecosystem. I mean, there are fungi that have benefits, there are fungi that have negative effects, there are fungi that, you know, overexpress and then they're negative, but when in kind of a managed or their normal state, it's nothing to worry about. So you kind of have this idea that there are fungal colonies in your home, and you point out, you know, some of the pink you might see in your grout on some tiles, or some around gaskets on a dishwasher. You might see a little bit of black that might be a mold living there. And yeah, it's no reason to burn the house down, but you talk about, you know, wiping that off, managing some of these areas, you know, and the biggest thing that you bring up is making sure wood does not get wet. That seems to be the biggest thing we can do, is try to address moisture intrusion points and wet wood in the house. Is that right?
Yeah, moisture and humidity control are the big things, because the xerophiles, the fungi that love to live in dry environments, they're not going to cause us very much harm unless they really go wild, and then there's, you know, hundreds of millions of spores in the air. But that's not likely to happen in normal circumstances. But the problem with water is that it often it leaks, and then you don't know, because it's in behind your wallboard, or it's underneath the floor, or it's underneath, you know, you've got a crack in the foundation, that kind of thing. So finding that, and even knowing that that's a problem, can be tricky, and that usually takes a specialist to find that. But when it comes to what ordinary people can do without that kind of intervention, like keeping the place vacuum, being aware if there's pools of standing water, like in a dehumidifier in your basement, that you make sure you clean that out regularly, so that you don't have a humidity or leakage problem. Normally, if you see mold growth, that's not a good thing. In one of my houses, I had drywall on the ceiling that was underneath the shower upstairs, and there was always a colony of Alternaria there. And I would go and I would clean it with ethanol every year or two. And I spent, like, every year I was up there in that bloody shower trying to regrout it and trying to figure out where it was leaking, and I never really managed to do that. It was probably leaking underneath, you know, in between the floor joists or something. But it wasn't a huge issue health-wise. It was just annoying, you know, and people don't like to see that. But if it had been Stachybotrys, it would have been a concern, but it wasn't. It was something else. And that's something that, again, you need a specialist who's able to look at a mold in a house and tell you whether or not it's a potential health threat.
And you talked about just making sure that, yes, whether it's going around that shower a million times, finding where the water is getting in is how you actually can do the most at stopping it, because you can clean it up, you can rip out the drywall, replace it, and if you still have that leak, it's just going to come back. So, again, it's managing this ecosystem and the ecological successions within your home that I found so interesting. And when we think about health impacts on humans, and I know there's so much work in this field and it's hard to quantify or establish causality and the exact impacts on human health from mold, but you brought up glucan and cytokine storms in the book. So when we think about, mold that is, I think some of the biggest ones are different strains of Aspergillus, Stachybotrys, Ketomium sometimes can have these associated negative health impacts. What exactly are they doing to the human body when we do have this negative mold health impact?
Well, you mentioned glucan. So many molds have glucan in their cell walls, and that's a polysaccharide, something like pectin. And it elicits a dramatic immune response in some people. And that's the cytokine storm. And so that's very, very uncomfortable for the people that have sensitivity to glucan. And that the one exception is Aspergillus fumigatus, which is a really serious human pathogen. And it's a problem in hospitals, which is a built environment. But it's less of a problem in houses, unless the houses are near like a huge composting facility, something like that. That one is a human pathogen, but mostly you don't see pathogenic species in the house.
Yeah, and it seemed like some of the bigger effects might have been something like allergic reactions from loads of spores or hyphal fragments and things like that being present in the environment. So I appreciated you laying out a landscape of mold in the house, managing those ecologies, but also giving us some kind of grounding that, look, just because you see mold does not mean that you are definitely impacted or having some negative health effect from it. So I really appreciated that level way of looking at it. But when we do think about the human microbiome, which you mentioned earlier, how much are fungi really involved? Because I know I often tell people about the yeast living in our stomach and that, humans have a lot of fungal colonies living within us. But your book talks a lot about bacteria and actually changed some of my framing of that. So, how involved are fungi in our human microbiome generally?
So there's not a monstrous diversity of, there's definitely thousands of species of bacteria in our guts. So that's not really the case with fungi. And they do get into our digestive systems. You mentioned yeast, and sometimes people deliberately eat yeast and as a probiotic. And so then, of course, it will be there. And most of the fungi that we consider part of the microbiome are on the skin, or around the orifices. And they're always there. And dandruff is always there. And 7 billion people have dandruff. And it's one of the reasons that we have dandruff is to get rid of some of the yeast that are on our skin. So it seems like they need to be there, but they shouldn't be allowed to get too thick or too pasty or too enthusiastic. It's like you need to be controlled. Candida is a really tricky one because it does seem to be a real symbiont around the orifices, as I said, but it changes during a person's life. So babies quite often have candida in them, and it gets quite aggressive, and it can be a real problem for babies. But as we get older, our immune system seems to come to some kind of negotiated settlement with candida, and then it's just there doing what it's supposed to do, unless it gets somewhere where it's not supposed to be. And so in hospitals, candida contamination of surgical instruments and catheters and things can be a serious issue. But most of us have it. It's supposed to be there. So, and then there's all of the other skin fungi that, like athlete's foot and so on. It's hard to imagine that these actually have any benefit for us, but right. A lot of people, I think 70% of people have what they call a dermatophyte. So a skin infection from a fungus at some point in their life, usually in their feet.
When you did talk about how candida however you pronounce it, might have some kind of beneficial effect at preventing other microorganisms from flourishing. So you always bring that perspective when you're talking about this, that there might be something beneficial that we just don't understand, that we're allowing it into our microbiome. You know, I just read an article today where I am in California. There's this rise of valley fever in Bakersfield in some areas of California. So I guess what are the threats from those kind of fungal diseases in the lungs and respiratory system? And how do we maybe protect ourselves from those kind of things?
Well, Aspergillus fumigatus, which I mentioned, is a killer. And the best way to avoid it is to not get into a hospital. Again, some people are very hypersensitive to it and other people just cough it out, you know? So there's definitely an individual response to that one. A lot of the fungal diseases are associated with immunocompromised conditions of patients. So whether the immunocompromising is from a disease like AIDS or through use of a immunosuppressant drug like cyclosporin A, those people are more susceptible to fungal infections and they need to be careful about the hygiene in their house. So they need to be in a clean environment. Then there are the diseases like the ones that you mentioned that are more environmental diseases, and they tend to be associated with bat guano or bird dung, or it's more viruses in rodent waste. But so you really need to make sure there's not bats and birds living in your attic and or in your barn, and they're not huge amounts of manure accumulating, because that's a high risk. The fungus needs to pass through that as part of its life cycle before it can get into a person.
Well, and I think you do a great job of pointing out in the book as well how we do have some inborn defenses. Mammals in general, being warm-blooded, have some inborn defenses to protect us against potential fungal pathogens or parasites that some of our animal brethren do not share, our reptile and amphibian brethren. You talked about, which is something I keep hearing more and more about, this amphibian apocalypse and chytrids and how they're impacting frog species. And then you even talked about how it may have been one of the factors that led to the extinction of dinosaurs, was their inability to fight off fungal infections. So as much as we might be impacted by them, it's a lot scarier world if you aren't a warm-blooded mammal.
Yeah, of course, the thing about dinosaurs is the theory. It's not my theory.
Of course.
Burrow, Castle, Duval. But it's a nice example of lateral thinking. It's really interesting, I think, the idea. But when I was a student, we were mostly worried about birds. But it's in the past couple of decades, the fungal diseases of reptiles and amphibians have really become a big thing. And it kind of stretches our concept of what a disease is. Because what the chytrid fungus does is give frogs heart attacks. So it does that by messing up the transfer of ions across the membranes in their blood system. So like that's pretty wild, you know. That's not what you normally think of as an invasive microbial disease. You know, you usually think of them colonizing the body and eating the body like the zombie fungi do. But that's I'm sure the chytrid is eating the body too, but the way it kills the organism is quite novel, it seems.
Yeah, again, it made me feel fortunate that we are warm-blooded mammals. And of course, a big part of the book, because we've talked about a lot of impacts, a lot of ways to manage ecologies. I think throughout, it's a very agnostic view of what fungi do. There's plenty of positive. You also focus on the pathogenic and parasitic. So there are times reading it where I start getting worried. How am I going to navigate this world? I mean, I love fungi. I love mushrooms. But am I putting myself at risk? You know, what if I get invaded by some of these fungi that unlock, that turn from, you know, end a fight to unlock some capacity on me? But you end the book with a great piece about myco potential and myco entrepreneurs and the abilities that we have to leverage these organisms to further improve our lives, further bring us in homeostasis with our environments. What are some of the biggest potentials you get excited about when it comes to novel uses of fungi, or what do you think some of the biggest potential points are in working with these organisms?
There's a lot of concern now about the state of the environment and carbon dioxide sequestering and so on. And fungi play a big role in this that can't be ignored. They do both. You know, they help us sequester carbon in forests by making forests possible, but they also break down those forests. So that's a balance that has to be put into the equation. You can't leave that out of the equation. You can't plant a trillion trees without thinking about what's going to happen to those trees in 100 years or 200 years from now. Fungi are also helping with the environmental crisis by they're quite central in the whole biofuels thing. And biofuels is a transitionary technology. We don't want to use combustible fuels forever, but as long as we are using combustible fuels, the more biofuel we can use, the less of the sequestered carbon that's in the petrochemical resources gets liberated. So that'll be a good thing in the long run. That's pretty prosaic stuff, though. It's not really what you would think of as being exciting. You know, it's just something that needs to be done. The exciting stuff is more in the wild ideas, I think. And I keep a Flipboard magazine on Flipboard, if you know what that is, but called Fungi in the News. And so I collect up all of these odd news stories and shovel them in there so that I can go back and look and see, oh, yeah, if someone had that strange idea of making a mushroom burial suit, or this woman in somewhere in the United States made a canoe out of mycelium of oyster mushrooms. And you know, I just love when the creativity really flows, because we need ideas. We need ideas as people to have an interesting life, and we need ideas as a society to have a successful society. And ideas are like an evolutionary entity. The good ideas survive and the bad ideas entertain us, and then they go extinct, and that's fine, you know. So I love the way that what I call the micro-entrepreneurs in the book approach the world, you know, whether or not they'll become rich, whether or not all of these wild ideas, some of them are going to come true. I think especially the ones that focus on lowering the amount of water that we need to use to get edible protein. Again, that's a boring thing to say, but it's an exciting possibility that we could eat a lot of. No one likes to admit they're eating processed food, but you know, if we're going to eat processed food, why not process it out of fungi? It's a lot more environmentally friendly than a herd of cows.
Well, yeah, a lot of the biggest impactful ideas still are kind of the simplest, like, hey, what if we replace more food, replacing materials? You do bring up that plastic dissolving, and actually had a great take on the plastic dissolving fungi. It was not necessarily growing fungi on a giant pile of plastic, but rather taking plastic dissolving enzyme slurries produced by those fungal organisms and pouring them over plastic to maybe help them dissolve. So yeah, you have loads of amazing ideas. And there's one passage in there where you describe the world powered by fungi and mycelium, you know, from every aspect of life. Now, was that pulling from your Flipboard? I think those were all real ideas.
They were all real ideas, and they come from the Flipboard thing. But and some of them are mentioned elsewhere in the book, but most of them aren't. You know, there's one in there about the bioluminescent yeast being used to light pathways, and talking about thinking outside the box. Boy, there's somebody who's thinking outside the box.
And actually, that highlights one of those big use cases you talk about, which is using yeast, and it seems like different ASCOs really as factories, which we already do. You know, when it comes to Aspergillus niger and citric acid, we already use these organisms as little chemical factories. Even if we don't quite understand the metabolism that gets us the output, we're starting to be able to put things in and realize they can transmute them into crazy outputs. But then you also talk about this idea, which again can be controversial, of inserting genes into some of these organisms that allow us to control maybe what they produce, like an enzyme that causes them to light up. So that's the fascinating part of these little yeast, these little ASCO factories and their ability to produce enzymes like crazy and what that means for our ability to work with them into the future. And I realize we've talked through like every chapter of the book. I had so many more questions I wanted to ask. For anyone who's been interested in any part of this, which I'm sure everyone has been, you need to get this book because it is even more dense, but like I said, very succinct. It covers such a huge territory, but in a way is also very practical in how we can interact with the findings and the ideas presented. I mean, for you, as this is your first book, what was the process like? You know, what's the reception been? Are you happy with it? All those kind of things that come after writing a book. What's that process been like for you?
It's been an education. We have a puppy right now. I mentioned at the beginning, you know, but fortunately he hasn't been barking. And I've been trying to decide whether it was harder to write a book or raise a puppy. And right now it feels like raising a puppy is harder. But anyway, it was definitely a challenge. And I had a great editor who was really didn't know a lot about mycology, but she knew how to tease it out of me. And if I wasn't delivering something that was comprehensible, she had no hesitation about very kindly telling me that that doesn't cut it, you know, try again. And that got frustrating. But part of it is that as an academic, you get used, you know, communication is part of it, but you don't realize it's not just jargon. You have a way of communicating with your colleagues, just the way you structure sentences, just the way you use certain adjectives or something. You use a five-syllable word instead of a two-syllable word because it's part of the lingo that of your field. And I hadn't realized how deeply embedded that was in me. It still is. Like when I write now, I do think I'm writing better than I did when I started this book. But at the same time, I go back and read it and I look at that sentence and say, no one can understand that sentence. I can barely understand it. So it was an education. But the publishing part has been a joy, actually. Everybody that I've worked with, it's a very different environment than scientific publishing. Everybody loves everything and they're excited about everything. And that's been a very positive experience. And I think the book is having a good reception, as far as I know. I haven't seen sales figures yet. That'll come in a month or so. But everyone seems happy so far. And as for me, I have to admit, I haven't read it since it was published. It'll probably be a few years before I can actually read it and with an objective eye and see what I really think of it. But I was satisfied with it when it was done.
Yes. Well, you're like that movie star that can't watch the movies they've been in yet. But I will assure you, it is fantastically well-written and comprehensible. And I really do think there's been a slew of mushroom and mycophilic books produced in the past couple of years. And I think we're going to see that trend continue. And I'm hard-pressed to find a book that, first of all, focuses on pretty much strictly microbial fungi and their massive impact on human society, gives you as much information about their capacities and different aspects of their lives, and bundles it all into a package that still remains very interesting. It's not overloaded with scientific language. The examples that get brought up, I mean, there's really fascinating stories told in just a couple of lines and why they're relevant and what it shows us about the fungi. And it's like hit after hit after hit. So I really did thoroughly enjoy the book and encourage people to get it. But where can people connect with you, Dr. Seifert, and where can people get the book?
So I'm on iNaturalist using my own name, so people can find me on iNaturalist. I'm going to guess that most of the people that listen to your podcast know what that is, and so I can be contacted in that way. I'm at Carleton University. I'm not sure, because I'm an adjunct, I'm not sure how easy it is to find my email address there, but that's one route. The book is widely available, so it may be in your local bookstores. If you can find it, there'll be a copy or two hidden away somewhere. And it's certainly on Amazon. And if you prefer to support local independent bookstores, I'm sure they either have it or will order it for you. And I know there's some independent sites on the web. I can't remember the name of the big one in the U.S., but there is one that that it's kind of Amazon-like, but it's for the independent publishers.
Yeah, yeah. If people want to go to the various bookshops.org and Better World Books, and I'm sure that you can find it anywhere. I mean, frankly, if you type in Dr. Keith Seifert, The Hidden Kingdom, you will be able to find it, and a very worthy addition to everyone's mycological library. And the worst question you can ask someone who just finished a book, but any future projects you have in mind? I mean, you're raising a puppy. That's like a full-time job. But any future projects or work you'd like to get to, you know, one day?
Well, I consider this a gateway book for me, like a gateway drug. You know, it wasn't really my plan to write a book about fungi, but it was my plan when I retired to write. And so this has given me an unexpected opportunity. So having said that, in the last year, I've been working on a book about the use of dogs in scientific research. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. And that's been an eye-opener, and it's sometimes quite heavy. But when I look at the puppy, I tell him, just be glad you're here and not in a lab.
Yeah, there's been a lot of that going around recently. So that's very interesting to write that history, especially alongside raising a puppy. So I'm excited to follow up with that one too. And then I'll have you leave us with a few questions I like to ask all of my guests. And the first one is just a mushroom or fungus that you love and why. And you do, like I said, cover hundreds, thousands of species in the book. So this can be just the mushroom of the moment or the fungus of the moment for you. But a mushroom or fungus you love and why?
The fungus, I get this question quite a lot. So the fungus that I've settled on is called Ascovopsis. And it is a mold that is a parasite of the Psittacomycete that's cultivated by leafcutter ants.
Yes.
People know about leafcutter ants, I think, and their huge nests, and that they cultivate Leucocyprinus. But there's this parasite that goes in there, and it's really a strange little fungus. And it looks like an aspergillus, but it has multiple heads, like instead of just one. And then the heads fall off. So instead of dispersing by spores, it's dispersing its head. And it jumps around like a strawberry plant. And you only see this in leafcutter ants. And this was known by ecologists about 100 years ago, 120 years ago. But taxonomists only caught up with it in the 1970s, 1980s. And since then, I was one of those taxonomists that got pulled into it by a Brazilian ecologist. And I didn't know what it was, you know. But since then, I've been involved with a student. He's a Peruvian guy. And he's got a monograph going. I think he's got 40 or 50 species of it. And they're all very specific to particular farming ant species. So talk about an odd symbiosis, you know. There's a symbiosis and there's another obligate parasite of that symbiosis.
Incredible. And yes, that is a whole fascinating part of the book as well, is diving into fungus farming ants, their society, those symbiosis, the gardens they cultivate, yes, other fungus along for the ride, even certain things that help protect them from other fungal entomopathogenic infections. So a fantastic answer. I actually did have that one in my notes that I sent too, because I thought that one was so cool. Well, then, you know, this relationship you've developed with all of these insane ecologies of organisms, you know, your own understandings over the years of seeing yourself as a holobiont managing all these ecologies. I mean, how has this relationship impacted you, and what has that really given to you? And that could be, you know, some greater spiritual awareness, that could be just lessons that you've learned. But what is this relationship you've developed with these ecologies of organisms, fungi, namely, given to you?
Well, I mentioned right at the beginning, you know, when you asked me how I became a biologist and this attraction I had to the hidden world. And there's an expression in French, tout dans le même bateau. We are all in the same boat. And everything I've done in science has kind of reaffirmed that little mantra for me. You know, we're all in this together, and we need the fungi and they don't need us. Mm. So maybe we should give them some respect.
I think that is a lesson that luckily we're learning more and more quickly. And I love to see the impact of how that skeins out into the world. And, you know, usually I ask a question at the end about how do you envision our future society or world, but I think your book does probably the best summary of that I've seen, of a world completely influenced by fungi and mushrooms, where we are these conscious symbionts. So I'll ask a question for someone who I think is a bibliophile. What books have you been reading recently, or what's something you're interested in? You know, outside, you haven't been reading your own book, but another book or something you've been interested in recently.
I'll name two books. One is called Darwin Comes to Town. And I can't remember what his name is. It's because he's Dutch. It's one of those 29 Schiltzhausen, I think. So that's about the study of evolution in cities. And that really dovetails a lot into, he doesn't talk about fungi, he talks about insects, he talks about rodents, he talks about birds. And that book really kind of turned my crank. There's one example in my book that I took out of his book. And the other one is a book I read a long time ago, but it's called The Song of the Dodo by David Quammen. And Quammen is an American science writer. He's one of the gods of science writing in the United States. Just an awesome writer. And The Song of the Dodo is about island biogeography, and which is on the surface about how islands are isolated evolutionary entities. And so that's the Galapagos example, where the different finches on the different islands, that island biogeography. But in his book, he walks through the concept of what an island is until he starts talking about virtual islands. And it makes you realize that it's another example of how humans look at the world in a certain way, and all the other organisms out there are looking at it in their own unique way. And so what's an island to a yeast, or what's an island to a mushroom, is totally different than what's an island to a person. And this really changed the way I thought about fungal evolution in particular, and fungal biology, because you realize that there's all of these very discrete environments out there, but what makes them discrete is something that you can't see. It might be chemicals, it might be a water gradient, it might be that it never sees any sunshine, it might be depth, it might be the heat coming up from the interior of the earth. And so Quammen's book, The Song of the Dodo, is really a great one. It really did change my life.
A fantastic couple of books to add to the library. And that last one, especially when we talk about managing ecologies and ecological successions, and also dovetails with the concept of Umwelt that I know you mentioned in your book, and how we understand ecological communities versus how other organisms would. Fascinating, fascinating material. Well, I have to say, Dr. Seifert, I really appreciate you being willing to come on the show. Again, do kind of a marathon running through the book as I pepper you with questions from all over as my neurons fire, and you were able to take all of that and give us beautiful answers and hopefully leave everyone listening wanting more, because this book has so much more to offer. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Darren. It's been nice to talk with you, and maybe you'll have to split it into two episodes.